Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining me now is social justice organizer and prison reform advocate Cecily McMillan. You may remember Cecily from her involvement in one of the more high-profile court cases to come out of the NYPD raid of Zuccotti Park, the Occupy movement in 2012, where some 200 Occupy Wall Street protesters were arrested. Cecily was convicted of second-degree assault on a police officer and served almost 2 months in Rikers Island. She documents in her new book how her time at Rikers inspired her to become an advocate for prison reform. The book is called The Emancipation of Cecily McMillan, an American memoir. She also discusses her upbringing in Southeast Texas and Atlanta and the beginnings of her political activism as a high schooler. So welcome back, Cecily McMillan, to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
I'm curious about the word emancipation as part of your title. Does that allude to your legal emancipation from your parents when you were 16?
It does. It also, the end of the book, I guess that the line is, the guards didn't free me that day, the women did. Reading their demands in front of the Rikers Island sign was my emancipation proclamation.
Yeah. Do you want to tell any of your teenage story, why you got emancipated from your parents, or, you know, anything else from Texas and Atlanta?
Sure. I was very challenging as a child. I would not want to be my parent. Let's put it that way. And growing up in Southeast Texas, going to Atlanta every summer and meeting firsthand Black people that were defined one way in Southeast Texas and was totally not true when I, in fact, met folks in person, became something that was a difficult barrier for me to grapple with.
In other words, it was a pretty much all white milieu in Texas, but then when you went to Atlanta, you met Black people?
Yes, is the less PC way to say that, but yeah. And I came home and I started challenging things at church, you know, the sort of hatred, not really following through with, you know, living in the lifestyle of Jesus. And then 9/11 happened and I found out what Muslims were. I was told essentially they were like Disney creatures that were living in caves with towel heads and they hated women and Christians and they were going to destroy the world with their black magic called Islam. And I was like, listen, I'm 13 years old. You're not selling me on this. So I started Googling and, you know, I typed in this horrible word. It was the sand inward into Google. I didn't understand how you could take this word that had meant black people and transfer it into these Muslim characters that I'd never met. And all of a sudden, I found all of this literature online about these poor Muslim folks who had come here escaping the same sort of forces that we were now the subject of attack, that had started small businesses and that were raising families here. And this was fiercely the American dream that I had been raised on. You're supposed to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And I came to school and I sat down for the Pledge of Allegiance and I stood during the moment of prayer and I got a paddling for it at school.
And this helped shape your political consciousness. So it sounds like it was already being shaped.
Yeah. I mean, James Byrd Jr. was another one. You know, that happened two towns over for me, the dragging of James Byrd Jr. And I remember like sort of my liberal response when I was a kid was, you know, that's just awful what happened to him. But a black man ought to know better than to be out at night in Jasper. And looking back on that, realizing this ought to, these lines that divide, how if everybody just follows the rules and we'll be okay, like that does not work when the rules are set definitively against people.
So all this racial and religious consciousness, and you wound up at the Occupy Movement encampment in Lower Manhattan. And that was really not about that. That was more about the kind of financial crisis and inequality in economics, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when we got there, what we were talking about was the gaping hole of inequality. And the reason why I ended up there and staying there is I mean, by that point, I had been adopted, in fact, by a black woman. So I became part of a black family. I started to really recognize my Mexican heritage that was really denied me as a child. And I went to college and I learned that I was poor and that you could say that, that we're not all middle class. And so when I showed up at Occupy Wall Street and there's all these really smart kids and adults from all around the world that had like done things, like real things in Greece and Chicago, I was like, okay, well, maybe I should be here and learn something.
So your story relates more than I realized to our last segment. I don't know if you were listening to it in the green room, but did your relationship with – it sounds like you grew up kind of identifying as white, and then you lived in a home with black people who adopted you.
Yeah.
And then kind of after that, you became more aware of your Latino part.
Yeah.
So how has your own relationship with your own whiteness changed over time?
Well, see, as a kid, I didn't realize that I was like culturally Mexican. I lived in a room in transitional homelessness with my mother for almost my entire childhood. So I am almost entirely culturally Mexican. But as a kid, I just thought I was unlikable. Like I'm not quiet. I'm not meek. You know, I don't say the right things. I'm very heated and animated when I'm passionate about things. I remember my mother, like I didn't say I love you once before I got out of the car, and she parked and she came in sixth grade and she just screamed across the cafeteria, "I love you, Sassy Poo." And that was this idea that you don't walk away from an argument, and if you have to cut it off, then you say I love you, you wrap it up and you come back to it. And so it was, yeah, it's something that when I went to Rikers, the women there knew that I was Latina more than I ever had immediately upon going in. And I said, well, how did you know? And they said, well, white people don't come here.
Right. Now, you've said that some of the recent reform packages implemented at Rikers, which are meant to curb the abusive relationship between guards and inmates, wouldn't stop the culture of violence. Why not?
Because ultimately what we're talking about is a state of chaos. There was the movie that came out recently, The Night Of, HBO, and I've been tracking sort of the differences. And the thing is if it's just a state of violence where somebody has power and somebody doesn't, then you can get used to anything. That's a rule of law. What was not shown in The Night Of and what does not exist at Rikers is a window where you can just go up and get your medications or like clothes that are given to you upon coming in or basic access to a library or medical attention or care. And so what you get is this bottoming out of like Maslow's ladder. I mean, a basic psychological stability that just damages you from the inside out. It corrodes. It's death to the soul, which is far more corrosive, I think, than death to the body, honestly.
Your trial for assaulting an NYPD officer in the Zuccotti mass arrest moment was embroiled in controversy, including the jury in the case, writing a letter to the judge, Ronald Zweibel, to protest your sentencing, and Judge Zweibel ruling out the majority of photos and videos from your arrest because, as you said, he found them too harmful to the reputation of the NYPD. So I'm afraid to ask, but what did you learn about the American justice system from your own trial?
That it is a just us system. There's no such thing. I mean, I got the best case scenario of anybody who went through that experience. I had Martin R. Stolar as my lawyer, like phenomenal man, you know, represented Attica. Mm. I mean, he's wonderful and he did it pro bono, which is unheard of. I had court clothes every day. I was free to go to and from court to look presentable like an honest person to the jury. I ultimately got 3 months of a sentence on a 2-year mandatory minimum. I mean, the thing is what my case shows is that if you choose to stand by the oppressed, then you will be treated like the oppressed. And there is no justice for your cultural capital, for your color, and even if you're a member of the club.
And I see that you have an interview with the New Republic that they put online today. And I want to read something to our listeners that that you were quoted saying in that, which kind of gives it to some of the Zuccotti Park demonstrators a little bit. You're right. They were saying, we are the 99%, but only the top 5% was represented in Zuccotti Park. I mean, what's a bigger slap in the face than choosing homelessness and then inviting people who are right on the brink to join you? They were making performance art out of other people's daily nightmare. Whoa.
I didn't know that came out. Well, okay, and the premise to that statement is that Occupy Wall Street was important in and of itself as a movement, building moment, not as a movement itself. And I think that what you had is all of these people, and Barbara Ehrenreich talks about this, who are in the educational system studying the poor without any sort of direct access to them or without any sort of modicum of an experience that lends itself to empathy. And in this case, I think the way that the Zuccotti folks, like, they stretch themselves and their experiential data and like really put themselves in a position to get beaten up, to get ghettoized for the first time ever, to not be listened to by people who they took for granted they would be listened to. And through this stretching, they did. They learned not pity, not sympathy, but how to empathize with those that are the 99%. But this was a huge step, and it was just simply as far as I think a lot of people could stretch.
It's a good thing. It's not, because I took that as kind of a criticism, making performance art of other people's daily nightmare.
Right. And I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that you really can't go there until you go there. Like, I could have made performance art of being in jail. You know, if I had chosen to say, I know my rights, instead of standing next to the women of Zuccotti and learning from them, having them direct me. But I mean, my brother has been in prison. Both of my parents are felons. It's like these are things that you learn by really putting yourself in the muck. And I think Occupy Wall Street, they put their money where their mouth is, and they got as close to the muck as they knew how to.
Are you going to vote in this election? And if so, with how much enthusiasm?
I'm a violent felon. I am not allowed to vote. And for that purpose, I tell everybody, voting is not an act of protest. It is a gateway to participation. Most people, a lot of people who are of the 99%, don't have access to or don't feel their voices can be heard. If you think you should be heard, vote for Hillary. Allow for the space for people to have the freedom to live their lives.
I thought in New York State, once you've served your time, you can get your voting rights back.
5 years probation.
Uh-huh.
We call that a setup in Rikers.
A setup?
A setup. So I'm in Atlanta. The appeal should be filed this week. Then I can be retried, actually, if I don't take a plea bargain. And then on to the very, very huge civil suit.
Cecily McMillan's book is called The Emancipation of Cecily McMillan, an American Memoir. And you have events. I don't have them in front of you, but you have something coming up in front of me at the New School and at NYU. Do you know them?
Yeah, at Cecily McMillan on Twitter, you'll be able to find the events. Tonight at 6:30 at the New School, Eventbrite. It's a panel called Mobilizing Privilege Against the New Jim Crow. There's four formerly incarcerated people. Tamamin is on the 21st. You'll be able to find that at the NYU Library.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will look at the new revelations about Big Sugar and how they paid for studies to try to blame fat for heart disease and take the spotlight off themselves. This is now out for the public to see some of this for the first time. Stay with us.